Hi, today's October 25th, 2020. This is Mobile Views Podcast 336. I'm Todd Ogasawara with my good friend John Westfall. I think it's going to be a short one, but we frequently say that and take up 45 minutes, so.
We shall see.
Yeah. The first news is no news. I think John and I were both hoping for an October 27th event that was rumored for the last several weeks that was supposed to announce the new Apple Silicon-based devices, because I think we both really want an Apple Silicon MacBook, or at least want to know about it if we don't
I'm just upgraded mine, so I'm not in any particular hurry to upgrade, but I want to see how they do in the wild.
Yeah, there you
That's
go.
That's sort of what I'm curious about.
Yeah, will it have a touchscreen since it's iOS or iPad OS compatible? I'm thinking probably not, but that's too bad because it would be awesome. But still, looking forward to it. I bought a MacBook Pro last year myself, so I really don't need a new MacBook. But if it runs iPad OS applications to some reasonable high percentage of compatibility, let's say 90%, I'd be pretty happy.
Now, it would be an interesting setup to be able to do that. You know, I think we've gotten very used to interacting with our MacBooks in the way we do and interacting with our iPads in the way we do.
Yep.
It could be an interesting crossover, but not one that I am particularly looking to happen anytime soon, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But you never know. You never know what's going to happen with these Apple's going in-house on their silicon. I'm also curious to see how Windows virtualization does or does not occur.
Yeah.
With Apple Silicon.
Yeah. And how are they doing it, right? How do they run existing applications designed for an Intel architecture? That's going to be interesting because you and I both are, you know, long enough MacBook or Mac users to remember when Apple shifted from the Power, what was it called? Power PC? Microprocessor, Motorola Power PC microprocessor back in Intel to, when was that, to 04, 05, somewhere thereabouts?
Yeah, that was around that era. And, we still had compatibility with Power PC up until about just a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, so, it was a pretty smooth transition for me.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really recall any huge problems. I didn't have a podcast then, so I didn't have to worry about audio applications and stuff. That came... Oh, that reminds me. We're coming up on year 12. Year 12 of the podcast. End of year 12, yeah. Mm-hmm. In November, right around the time you switch to standard time. But yeah, really looking forward to that, especially if it's reasonably priced, right? I mean, normally when Apple announces a new MacBook, it's like, ugh, I can't afford it. And, at least not if I just bought one last year, I can't afford it. You know, but if it's significantly under $1,000, which is basically iPad Pro range, low-end iPad Pro range, that'd be something to look at. All right. Also looking at compatibility on a different box, my Chromebooks. I ran into a couple of really annoying problems over the last 3 or 4 weeks. And it's this. Microsoft Teams, which I use 7 days a week at work. Microsoft Teams will not run in at least one of my Windows Chrome browsers. It will run if I switch to Firefox or Edge. And will not run on, I think, two of my Chromebooks. Which, now that I think of it, both are Intel-based. The two it doesn't run. It runs on the two ARM-based ones, I think. I got to go check that. But it definitely doesn't run on two of the only two Intel-based Chromebooks I have. And I tried, clearing the cache, and I think I even tried power washing, you know, which is basically doing pretty close to a factory reset and then restoring files, but that didn't work. The Android app does work, but the Android Teams app is horrible, unlike the iOS Teams app, which is pretty darn good. And so that's not really a solution on the Chromebook. And so in desperation, I tried something I didn't think I ever wanted to do. I installed Microsoft Edge, the Chromium based one. And the way I did it is I didn't have the Linux container running on the particular Intel based device I have, Intel based Chromebook I have. So I said, well, let's turn it on. It's an i5, so it's a pretty hefty, you know, for a Chromebook, it's a pretty hefty processor.
Mm-hmm.
So I not installed Linux, but I turned Linux on. It's part of the Chromebook experience, you know, if you want to. So I turned it on. I've done this before. It works pretty well, but I just didn't feel like I needed it in this particular one. And then I installed Microsoft Edge for Linux in the container. And voila, I can use Teams, the browser-based Teams, on my Chromebook again. I still can't use it in Chrome. But at least if I'm running in a Linux container with, I think it's a beta release of Microsoft Edge, Chromium-based Microsoft Edge, it works. I also tried I installed the beta version of Microsoft Teams for Linux, the actual FAT app. But that didn't launch, and I suspect that's a problem with X11 as it's implemented in the Linux container. And it does have some interesting limitations. It might be trying to open a window outside of the container window, which doesn't seem to work. So a couple of things like that, but that was my other compatibility solution.
Yeah, Chromebooks, that's sort of, you know, being in the education sector right now, we have this weird battle of Chromebooks going on, where in K-12, Chromebooks rule the roost, and a lot of schools are on, you know, Google Classroom, and that's how they're doing their distance learning.
Yep.
And yet, once they get to the university level, Chromebooks are the most evil things that we deal with.
What?
Because most of the software that we need our students to be able to run doesn't run on a Chromebook. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, like, for example, I don't know, very vertical apps, like for chemistry or something.
Well, that's one part of it. Courseware definitely is a part of it. Test security is one of the biggest problems we have for doing remote proctored exams. The software that we use, which is called Respondus Lockdown, doesn't run on a Chromebook at all.
So
instructors that would like to give remote exams with some level of security, you know, proctoring and video recording and, you know, making sure people aren't switching windows to look up answers while they're taking the exam.
I never thought of that. So what does the video recording part do for this proctoring application?
You can literally set it to record video while the student's taking the exam. So that later, I've reviewed these videos where you see the student quite visibly, you know, looking over to the right where their phone is as they're looking up answers for the exam. So, you know, this is software that isn't just in higher ed. A lot of companies now, when they interview people and do a code interview or a code examination, they require these same sorts of pieces of software to be used.
I did not know that.
And then if you're just thinking about Microsoft Office, you know, our business classes require the use of Office. You can use a Mac or Windows PC, because they don't typically require the macro features of Windows, but it needs the Office. You cannot be Google, so Chromebooks are great in K-12, but if I have anyone ask me, you know, what kind of computer should I get for college, not a Chromebook.
Interesting.
It just isn't ready for that level of what we needed to do in academia.
You know, it's interesting you see that, because when my daughter went to college, I got her a MacBook, and that was not a problem. But when she went to grad school, she didn't run that, you know, she ran into a conundrum, not a problem. And that was, the grad school specifically stated you need to have a Windows laptop to run Excel macros, which, you know, as you just said, Excel doesn't support macros under Mac OS. So I had to go get her Parallels, install that on. And then, of course, I had to buy a full copy of Windows for her. So that was kind of expensive. But I did. I think even with educational discount, it was kind of expensive. So, you know, I bought for it under her name, since she could get the discount. But it was still a couple $100, I think, to do that, you know, to get Parallels and Microsoft Windows on her MacBook. But it worked, you know, so it's interesting you say that. I did not, you know, in this day of remote everything, I didn't know about the remote proctoring, which makes sense. I just never thought about it, because I don't have to deal with it. But that leads us to our next topic. and it doesn't probably help colleges any. But if you are in a business, Parallels released Parallels Desktop for Chromebooks. So you can now run Windows on a Chromebook. You could always run Office on a Chromebook, but it wasn't, you know, as John alluded to, it wasn't the full Office. It was either the web version or the Android fat app, and it's missing a few features. But at any rate, so and I have a link to The Verge, which talks about Parallels Desktop for Chromebooks, only for the Enterprise Edition, though, so you can't do this at home. You have to be part of an Google Chromebook Enterprise operation to do this. Still kind of interesting, though. I'm not sure, you know, given that you need an Intel device for the Chromebook, you can't run it on an ARM-based Chromebook. You're still talking about a pretty hefty price for the Chromebook, $500,000 US, and for which you can buy a pretty decent Windows laptop these days. So I'm not sure there's any price differential. And since you have to secure Windows, you know, in Parallels, maybe it's just pure remote management, you know, where you can wipe the device more easily, because a power wash on a Chromebook is really fast to both, you know, power wash the device and restore it. It's like minutes. So I'm really not sure what the deal is, and I find it intriguing. I just need to understand the use case better. But if you really need to run Windows and you really want to use Chromebooks, there you go. And of course, nobody can find Chromebooks right now because, as John alluded to, you know, the K-12, because they're all in, well, not all, but many people are in remote learning situations. Chromebooks are flying out the manufacturing floor. I've been wanting to buy a Lenovo Chromebook Duet for months and months and months now, since it came out, I think, in May. But it's always sold out, you know, or you got to pay like a $100 premium, which I'm not willing to do. So I guess I'll never have one, because by the time the pipeline is restored, probably the version 2 will be out. Maybe I can get that. Okay, speaking of versions, so I still don't have an iPhone 12 Pro, unlike some people. I walked by a local Apple store on Friday, and I saw people standing outside the Apple store in line. So I guess some people got it, but not me. Still waiting. I did get my Beats Flex headset, though. And the first thing I found out when I tried to use it was I had to upgrade to iPadOS 14.1, which I didn't even know was out. So it will not run on 14.0.1. You need to have 14.1 to even pair the headset to your iOS device. That was kind of a surprise. It doesn't support spatial audio, which we'll talk about a little bit more later, by the way. So it's, you know, it's a $50 headset. I didn't really expect it to, but I thought it'd be a nice surprise. It does have a USB-C charging port like the new iPad Air. So, you know, and it doesn't come with a charger. Also like the new iPad, I think, the new iPad Air. Does it come with one? Not sure. iPhones don't come with a charger anymore. So, you know, you'll need to have some kind of charger, but it does come with a USB-C to USB-C cable, which is interesting. So you'll need a USB-C hub of some kind, you know, with a PD port, mm-hmm. Which I do, so it's not an issue. But it's kind of a, you know, I'm trying to figure it out. It's kind of ungainly. It's got this I won't call it rigid, but for lack of a better term, a semi-rigid neck. You know, it's not a typical cable like you have on, say, the regular wired ear pod. Right, and so it kind of sits their neck, unless you have a collar, like I wear a t-shirt a lot of times, so on a t-shirt, it just sort of rubs against your neck uncomfortably. If you have a collar, the collar kind of holds it down, so it's okay. And it took me a while to learn how to use the power button. You got to hold it exactly like 1 second and let it go, otherwise it goes into pairing mode. But it does
have a... very particular.
Yeah, so...
It makes you fight for what you want it to do.
Yeah. And so I think I've gotten to the point where I can kind of do it without, you know, going into pairing mode. In the beginning, I was pretty awkward with it. And it, although it comes with the one that I thought was going to be exciting, it comes with four sizes of silicone ear adapters. And I used the biggest one, and it still doesn't fit good, you know. But that said, because it's cabled between the earbuds, it doesn't, you know, even if it falls out, it's not a big deal because it's, you know, around my neck. So I'm okay with that. And I'm really happy that it has, physical volume controls that I can, you know, touch, as well as a pause, play, skip button. And it has, you know, like a lot of earbuds, it has these wired earbuds. It has these magnets on the back of the earbuds opposite the ear tip that stick together. And if you stick it together, it also acts as a pause button. So if you just take them out of your ears and you stick them together, it pauses whatever you're playing. You release the magnet, you pull the magnets apart, and it starts playing again. And also, if it is in this state, you know, it's, let's say it's dangling around your neck with the ear pods magnetically attached to each other, and a call comes in, all you have to do is detach the magnets, and again, you answer the call. So I thought that was pretty cool. Nobody ever calls me, so I haven't had a chance to to try it. Not that I'm asking people to call me, by the way. I'm just saying. It's not something I've had a chance to try. If they were to call. Yeah. You know, but so for $50, I'm not complaining about some awkwardness with it, I think. I'm hoping they'll change the neck brace part of it at some point. In V2, maybe next year. And again, you know, for $200-something, you're not going to buy a new AirPod Pro every year. At least I'm not. But for $50 a year, I would buy a V2 in 2021. So here's hoping for 2021. Oh, and also the battery life is rated 12 hours. I'm going to say that's probably optimistic. I used it for a conference call that lasted about an hour, and it dropped from 100% to about 85%. So 15% every hour is not 12 hours. It's more like, what, seven and a half hours? But hopefully you're not on a 7.5 hour conference call, so it's probably fine. And it's supposed to have a fast charge where, you know, you plug it in for, I don't know, 15 or 20 minutes, and it gets you to, I don't know, another hour and a half of listening or something. So no real complaints. It's, you know, just a couple of comments about what seems to me as a little bit physically awkward, and maybe it's because of the kinds of earbuds and headsets I've been using for the vast majority of my life. But I'd recommend them. I'd recommend them.
That's pretty decent for the price, I would say.
I think so, too.
Minor things, but I'd say all in all, not a problem.
Oh, and the last thing. Unlike the AirPods Pro, it doesn't, quote-unquote, automatically switch between devices. And my AirPods Pro don't anyway, so I'm discounting that as a minus. But I will say this. I've paired it with, you know, like my iPad Pro, iPad Mini, and my iPhone. And it's just like the AirPod Pro. It's really easy to switch between them. You just go to Bluetooth and tap on it and it connects. You don't have to repair or whatever every time you change a device like several other Bluetooth headsets I have require. So I'm pretty happy with that. It does, like I said, mostly it doesn't fall off my head and, you know, get lost somewhere I can't find it. So that for $50, it's well worth it.
Well, I know that was the big concern that you've had with AirPods.
Yeah.
So I think for that, it is a useful thing. Hopefully Apple will continue branching out into these lower price points, but yep, still functional things. I think Apple, for a number of years, started to go a little bit too much toward the higher end.
Oh, yeah.
So perhaps now they're getting a little bit of an idea, especially with the iPhone SE, Apple Watch SE, these headphones. I think they're starting to say, well, maybe there are people that don't need all the bells and whistles, and
maybe there are people who aren't rich.
Basic product. That too.
Yeah. Oh, maybe not rich, but, you know, have disposable income at that level. Apple stuff is expensive, even though I happen to like this stuff, but they are expensive. Okay. Speaking of expensive, so, you know, John and I have been talking about spatial audio feature in iOS 14 for the last couple of weeks. And so last week, John, you know, again reminded me that, oh, you know, you can go to Disney Plus and try something and you know, try to get a good experience of spatial audio. He says, oh, okay, I've got Disney Plus. Let's go do that. So I think I put on Black Panther and a few other things. And I said, geez, whiz, I don't hear spatial audio. And I was using the device I mostly use for media playback, which is my 2018 iPad Pro 10.7. And so I go look at my settings. Oh, maybe I forgot to set it. So I go into Bluetooth, I tap on iPad AirPods Pro, and hey, there's no spatial audio option here to turn on. So I went to my iPhone. Yeah, it works on my iPhone 10. which is also 2018, 10S. And then I went to go look at my iPad Pro 2020, the 11-inch that came out earlier this year. And that one works. So I went to Apple's support page and found that, it doesn't support my older devices. It only supports, it's very specific, it supports most iPhones from iPad 7 up, which is pretty old. But on the iPad side, the oldest iPad, the only iPad mini it supports is a 5, which fortunately I have. And then you need a third generation iPad Pro 12.9 or the 11, which I have, or the new-ish iPad Air or the new iPad. So if your device, your iPad is any older than late 2018, you don't have spatial audio. So I had to switch to my new iPad to watch Disney Plus and go, oh yeah, now I think I hear it. I hear the difference.
Yeah, and that's something I don't think Apple was very forthcoming about when they announced spatial audio, the fact that it was going to be a very recent thing. So if you had older devices, you might have the newest AirPods, but if you're using them on a device that's a little older, and your devices are not all very old,
no,
but they are, you know, I guess 3 years is too old in Apple's book.
Yeah, except for the iPhone. It goes all the way back to the iPhone 7, which I found, you know, I thought that the same generation iPad Pro, for example, would be at least as acoustically sophisticated as iPhone 7, but apparently not. I wonder what the difference is, you know? Some special audio chip or some version of the ARM processor? I don't know. I'm just speculating at this point. Okay, the next thing, you know, John, I don't know if you've been watching your SpO2 levels on your Apple Watch 6, but I have, especially since, you know, people are talking a lot about SpO2 levels for, you know, as an indicator of various kinds of ailments. And mine is all over the place, you know. It ranges from, I'm looking at it now in the last week, let's go to the last month. Okay, so last month, it's ranged from 89%, which is pretty darn low. I mean, I remember when my father was very ill, they were really worried when it dipped down into that range. So it ranges from 89 to 100%, and it's just all over the place. And it's fairly consistent. It doesn't always go down to 89. Generally, the low, you know, threshold is like 91, which is still low in my opinion. And to make things more interesting, I bought one of those pulse oximeters, you know, dedicated pulse oximeter a couple of months ago that you put on your fingertip. That's, you know, I probably medical grade, I think. And I never dip below, you know, 97% O2. So, not that I, you know, wear it all day, but when I do check it, I don't have these huge range swings. So I happened to go see a Tom's Guide article about the Apple 6 blood oxygen measurement. And they note that the SpO2 sensor or system in Watch 6 is not FDA approved, unlike Watch's ECG, its electrocardiogram feature, which is FDA approved, as you know, for medical monitoring. So that's a thing to look at, I think. You know, it does have huge, and an article does note that it seems to have large range of values recorded, and so, you know, not to get alarmed if your SpO2 seems a little low.
Yeah, and I looked at mine just now, and you're right. Mine is, I've got these outliers that are down below the 95% range, but they are, looking at the month, they are very much outliers. You can tell that they're not happening very frequently. And even on the day level, looking at them, they're pretty infrequent. So I think it's just one of those things where you have to, this would have been a better place for, instead of using range, to use the median SpO2. That would have given a much more accurate range. And I also do have a pulse oximeter as well that occasionally I use. And when I have tried to compare them side by side, they've compared pretty well. So I think this is one of those things that's a nice feature to have, but I wouldn't rely on it for medical diagnoses either.
And go see your doctor, you know, your physician. If you have any concerns, don't rely on this. I think right now, because it's not FDA approved, it's interesting. And, you know, if you're concerned, you should go see a health professional.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement to make.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we really are fast this week.
Some weeks we can do it fast, I suppose.
Yeah. I was really hoping that we'd have something to talk, Apple Silicon, to talk about next week, but apparently not. So we'll see what's going on. I know one more thing I wanted to add. It's not in our show notes, but that's 5G. So I don't know if I mentioned it last week, but I looked up 5G coverage here, and AT&T and Verizon don't have any 5G coverage around where I am, anywhere in the state. T-Mobile and Sprint have like really spotty coverage. And in particular, there's one street in the middle of nowhere. It's not even downtown Honolulu. It's like 3 miles from downtown Honolulu that has great Sprint T-Mobile 5G coverage. I assume that's their test lane. And then, you know, again, if you're buying an Apple iPhone 12 or the new Pixel 5 or 4A 5G for 5G, you should check coverage maps, because you may not get any. You may be like me and go, I've got it, but it's of absolutely no use. So,
yeah, I think if you're buying this phone thinking it's for 5G, it's not.
Yeah, unless you live in one of the, you know, 5G test cities, like, I don't know, San Francisco, New York, I guess. One of those kind of places. But even then, you got to be outdoors, too. And it's winter's coming for, you know, in Honolulu, it doesn't really matter. But winter's coming for many of you, and you probably aren't going to be spending that much time just walking around testing 5G. Because it's, you know, it's wall penetration is zero. And you need, I think, I forget which version of the millimeter wave, but I think it's a 5G cell is only 800 to 1,000 feet line of sight. So, you know, 3 football fields with no walls in between. I'm really not sure when it will be a useful feature. Certainly not in 2020, maybe not in 2021.
Yeah, I think that's the good advice. Don't buy it thinking you're going to be using it for the speed.
Yeah, for most people, 90-something% of the people. And I don't even know what they're going to charge us, you know, for using 5G. If it's going to be different, it's going to be the same. And what about your, you know, I guess if you have unlimited data, which I do not have, it doesn't matter. But I don't have unlimited data, so I'd have to be very careful. Any rate, relatively short MobileViews podcast 336. Thanks to John, as usual, for hanging out with me for the podcast. And we will talk to you next time.